Today is Friday, May 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, we'll have more on a story coming up. Also had tens of thousands of businesses and other organizations in North America and Europe were targeted by an Eastern European cybercrime syndicate. And the U.S. is ratcheting up the pressure on Iran. It's all on today's International Edition. Authorities say tens of thousands of businesses and other organizations in North America and Europe were targeted by an Eastern European cybercrime syndicate in recent years. Yesterday, a U.S. prosecutor unsealed a criminal case against defendants in five countries using the Gosnam malware. North American and European police say 11 cybercriminals infected more than 41,000 computers with a malware program known as Gosnam in an attempt to steal more than $100 million from bank accounts. Six of the conspirators are in custody in the U.S., Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine. Well, VOA's Masoud Farivar joins us in the studio for more on this story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kim.
Well, Masoud, how did this cybercrime take place? Like, what did the criminals do to get people or to get the money?
So they used the oldest trick in every cybercriminal's bag of tricks. It's called phishing. So what happens in a phishing attack is that a legitimate looking email is sent to a company employee with a link asking that the link be clicked. And now the employees in question thought they were getting an invoice or a bill. Instead, they gave away their most personal sensitive information, including their banking logins.
And so from this, and the cyber criminals just go into the bank account and...
There are multiple people involved in this conspiracy. Once the login information is captured by this malware, the information is shared with someone else in the network who will access the bank accounts and try to make unauthorized transfers into bank accounts that this network controlled.
And what prompted this investigation?
So this investigation, this case began a couple of years ago with a separate FBI investigation into another network called the Avalanche Network. Now, the Avalanche was kind of a delivery platform for a lot of malware campaigns, including this Gosnam malware campaign. That was taken down by the FBI in late 2016, and it resulted in the prosecution of one of the hackers that was named in yesterday's indictment.
Now, I understand you spoke with one of the victims of this crime. What did they say?
It's interesting because I tracked down one of the victims that was an unnamed victim in the indictment. They're based in Illinois, a small association that provides recreation programs for people with disabilities. In early 2016, they received an email. One of the employees clicked on it. And the hackers got access to their bank accounts. But as soon as that happened, their two different banks caught wind of it and froze their funds. And so the good news, they said, is that they didn't lose any money.
Yeah, that's really good. So cybercrime is, you know, is a worldwide crime. So how do authorities fight this type of criminal activity because it's on such a large scale?
It's not only on a very large scale, but it's a crime that's borderless and calls for a borderless solution. That's, I think, there's a growing recognition among law enforcement officials for greater, that there needs to be more and more international cooperation between law enforcement agencies. That's why in recent years you have seen greater cooperation, and almost every major takedown of a cyber network has resulted from very close cooperation between law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and Europe.
And once the defendants, once these people is it easy to prosecute a case like this and get a conviction?
So that's a very good question. The challenge for prosecutors is not so much convincing a jury to convict a suspect or a defendant. The challenge is getting the suspect extradited. Oftentimes, these cyber crooks live in countries that the U.S. doesn't have extradition treaties with. So in this case, what the prosecutors did was unprecedented. The FBI conducted joint searches of these suspects in their home countries. And afterwards, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Pittsburgh in the Western District of Pennsylvania shared the evidence with the prosecutors in three countries, Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, where these are three countries that we don't have extradition treaties with, but where the suspects are now being prosecuted.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for this very interesting coverage that you've been doing. That's VOA's Masoud Farivar. Thank you. Among the top stories in the world, Taiwan's parliament legalizes same-sex marriage today in a landmark first for Asia. A foreign military airstrike in Afghanistan's embattled southern Helmand province mistakenly kills at least 17 government forces and wounds 14 others. And China cuts back on its imports of American pork by $6.5 billion, seriously impacting U.S. pork farmers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. is ratcheting up the pressure on Iran through diplomatic, economic, and now even military means. However, National Security Advisor John Bolton has said the U.S. is not seeking war with Iran, but will respond to any attack. Iran, in turn, has used its own tough language, warning it will respond to provocations. Paul Salem is president of the Middle East Institute in Washington, and he spoke with our VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about whether such escalation could lead to a military confrontation.
Yes, it could. The U.S. has basically been using economic sanctions against Iran. Iran made it clear a couple of weeks ago, partly through public statements made by the Iranian foreign minister, that it would not sit idly by while its economy was brought to its knees, and that it threatened imposing costs on either the U.S., but more likely on U.S.'s partners in the region, such as the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. has made a big public case about moving aircraft carriers and B-52 bombers in the region. So we are in a very, very dangerous standoff that certainly could lead to further escalation and a much wider war.
But National Security Advisor John Bolton said the United States is not seeking war with the Iranian regime, but fully prepared to respond to any attack, whether by proxy, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, or regular Iranian forces. What do you make of that?
Well, we are in a traditional escalation trap that both sides, the U.S., I think, does not want a major war with Iran. Iran does not want a major war with the U.S., but the positions taken by both sides cause escalation that certainly could lead to war, even if both sides do not actually want that war. I think right now we're seeing that both sides are aware of this danger, and we've seen statements both from Washington and Tehran trying to calm tempers and to avoid a quick escalation. But this escalation trap, the situation still remains, and it will require either mediation by third parties or some kind of wiser heads to prevail so that we can move back from this escalation towards a calmer situation.
Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council, argued that members of the Trump administration appear to be repeating the George Bush administration's playbook for war with Iraq. Do you see any similarities? And if hostilities took place, who are the potential winners and losers?
No, I don't think we have a similar situation to the run-up to the Iraq War. The run-up to the Iraq War was preceded by actually a decision by the Bush administration to prepare for an invasion of Iraq. That certainly is not the case now. This administration, led by President Trump, has not planned for or has not taken any decision to go to war with Iran, and I'm quite sure that if that were presented to Donald Trump as an actual war, he would say no. I think what we are seeing is quite clear. It is a form of increased pressure, part of the general maximum pressure campaign against Iran, which now also includes saber rattling or military threat that might include a willingness to undertake some military strikes on Iran, maybe either through missiles or through aircraft, if Iran does something provocative. Now, the consequences of escalation, I think there would be many, many losers if it escalated into real conflict that would involve U.S. and maybe allied air forces and missile systems, and Iran would certainly respond with its own missile systems and anything else it could manage. Such a conflict would have serious consequences on Iran and in Iran in terms of targets that might be hit there, but I think it would also leave the UAE and Saudi Arabia extremely vulnerable to Iranian missiles, and there might be extensive damage in the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which would have a huge impact on their economy. A bit further from the Gulf, Hezbollah in Lebanon has said that if Iran is attacked, they would enter the fray, and certainly their target would be Israel, and then Israel would retaliate at least on Lebanon, which would lead to massive destruction in Lebanon, as well as high cost in Israel. Iran, in a wider war, could also try to target U.S. forces, maybe in Iraq, or in other locations in the Middle East, and could use cyber warfare tactics inside the U.S., in the U.S. mainland, against U.S. infrastructure and U.S. institutions. The winners, I don't think there'd be any clear winner.
That was Paul Salem, president of the Middle East Institute in Washington. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. Well, the humanitarian aid ship Sea-Watch is looking for a safe port for 65 migrants it rescued off the coast of Libya on May 15th. The ship is now close to Lampedusa, an island off the southern coast of Sicily. However, Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Salvini is adamant that Italian ports remain closed and called the rescuers human traffickers. I spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome about the suffering that the migrants are experiencing from their journey.
The NGO Sea-Watch picked up these 65 migrants off the coast of Libya. They include migrants from Mali, Niger, South Sudan, and Nigeria, and young children. I'm not quite sure how many children, but they have made their way across the Mediterranean, very rough conditions, and are now very close to the coast of Lampedusa, that island off the south coast of Sicily. Great concern, because the Italian government has made it clear they're not welcome in Italy. The Interior Minister Matteo Salvini says the ports in Italy remain closed to migrants who arrive by boat, and he's adamant he's not going to give in. So the fate of these migrants at the moment remains very unclear.
Where are they from and what is their condition at this time?
Well, we know from some of the statements that they come from Mali, Niger, South Sudan, Nigeria, and other African countries. They've made their way through Libya, and Sea-Watch is very concerned about the state of their condition. Many are suffering from dehydration and have been very ill with rough sea conditions crossing the Mediterranean. They're also traumatized because they've spent months in Libyan detention centers, and they're concerned about the state of the migrants, particularly young children. A very difficult situation there, and Mr. Salvini is saying he will not budge. And he's even calling the NGO operators human traffickers. He's accusing them of being human traffickers, which is a very serious allegation.
So what then is the next step?
Well, the organization says that it's tried to make contact with Libya, Italy, Malta, and the Netherlands. All these countries have refused to accept these migrants. So at this point, it is looking like a standoff. But once this vessel enters Italian waters, it would seem that there's an obligation on the Italian government to accept the migrants and then decide their fate, whether they may be sent to other countries. That will remain in the hands of Mr. Salvini. He says he's not going to budge. He says he's not even going to be told what to do if the Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte intervenes and asks him to accept these migrants.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. Well, as U.S. President Donald Trump intensifies his trade battle with China, one of the hardest hit countries could be South Korea. Asia's fourth largest economy, South Korea, is especially vulnerable to the tariff war because of its reliance on foreign trade, in particular exports to its two biggest trading partners, China and the U.S. South Korea sells electronic components to China, which are in turn used in products that China sells to the U.S. After U.S.-China trade talks broke down, Trump last week raised tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports and threatened to do so with $300 billion more. China retaliated with tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. goods. Well, the trade war escalation, which rattled markets and threatened to hold back global growth, comes at an especially bad time for South Korea, whose economy unexpectedly contracted in the first quarter. This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Coming up this Sunday, Mother's Day special.
Yeah, 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 mama. Whoa.
55 minutes of your favorite African songs that speak to, for, and about your mamas. Or about you, mamas.
Mama.
Now, one mother and diva of Malian music, Oumou Sangaré, speaks to us from Wassaloum country about her music festival there, and Song of the Week features Akodi and her song Shengerera Mama.
I'm sorry, mama yangu.
So tune in and feel the love. Music Time in Africa, 1505 and 20500 Universal Time.
Australia's vote in a general election tomorrow. The management of the economy has been central in the campaign. It has not been in recession since the early 1990s, but the economy is showing signs of slowing down. The environment is another key concern for voters as the campaign enters its final days. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The best welfare is a job. The best security is a home. The best life is a family. The best country is Australia.
Money is being pumped into this election campaign like never before. Cash-infused minor parties, including one backed by a billionaire mining tycoon, are competing with the two dominant players, the centre-right Liberal National Coalition and the Labour opposition. Stuart Jackson is from the University of Sydney.
We are seeing expensive elections. We've been seeing them for some time. I actually think you will see the expenditures go up considerably at this election. There's an awful lot of television advertising, but then also onto Facebook and onto Twitter and Instagram and the social media platforms.
Scott Morrison, the Liberal Party Prime Minister, is asking voters to trust his management of the economy that's based on a simple philosophy.
My family story is not uncommon in our country. Australians quietly going about their lives with simple, decent, honest aspirations. Get an education, get a job, start a business, take responsibility for yourself, support others, work hard.
The economic focus of the opposition Labor leader Bill Shorten is major tax reform.
We've said that we want multinationals to pay their fair share. I announced yesterday a new scheme to stop some multinationals treating the Australian tax system as a doormat, which they wipe their boots on coming in and out of Australia.
You have to stop driving climate change. Take actions now out of the very range.
For many Australians, the environment is their number one concern in this election. A lightning rod for conservationists is the Carmichael Mine in Queensland that's proposed by the Indian company Adani. It would be one of the biggest coal mines in the world if it goes ahead. Mary Carroll, who runs a tourism agency in the city of Rockhampton, says the region needs the resources industry.
There's seven mines at the moment. They're all going through their approvals process at the moment. And I think one of the fears out there, with all of the talk about one particular mine, i.e. the Carmichael mine, is that if it doesn't proceed, perhaps the others won't.
But a Queensland voter, Rochelle Rodia, says the Indian-run project must be rejected.
Adani is just no no, no. If Adani opens up, the whole Galilee Basin opens up. Terrible. Disaster for Australia. Disaster for the world.
Australia's Climate Council, an independent campaign group, is warning that if left unchecked, global warming could wipe more than $2.5 trillion from the domestic economy over the next 80 years. The council's chief executive, Amanda McKenzie, says the situation is already dire.
What this report shows us is that there is real cost of failing to act. In the last 4 years, pollution has gone up and up and up in Australia. At the same time, we've seen mass bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef. We've seen nearly 50-degree days in some parts of Australia, fruit cooking on trees. There are real costs of failing to act on climate change, and that's what we've tried to quantify in this report.
16 million Australians are eligible to vote. Many yearn for political stability and an end to party infighting in a country where it's been more than a decade since a prime minister served a full term in office. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases divided 20 volunteers into two groups for a month-long experiment. One group ate diets that consisted of ultra-processed foods, while the other group ate less processed foods. Ultra-processed foods are those that usually contain plenty of additives like artificial flavoring, added sugars, stabilizers, and preservatives. Meals for both diets had the same amount of calories and nutrients, but the volunteers were allowed to eat as much or as little as they desired. The researchers found people on the ultra-processed food diet ate faster, consumed about 500 calories more per day, and gained more weight than those eating slightly processed foods. Volunteers on the slightly processed food diet also lost about the same amount of weight that those on the highly processed food diet gained. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, high-tech specialists gather this week in Paris for the AfroBytes and VivaTech conferences. It is an opportunity to look at the progress that new high-tech startups have made on the continent with champions like Jumia, the largest ever African initial public offering on the New York Stock Exchange. Nicolas Pinault met some of them in Paris and has details.
African startups are doing very well, and fundraising is booming on the continent. According to Partech Africa, a venture capital firm, in 2018, 146 startups in 19 African countries raised $1.16 billion for African digital entrepreneurs. Kenya, Nigeria, and South Africa received 78% of the total funding, with Egypt close behind. In French-speaking Africa, Senegal is the leading hub, with $22 million raised in four deals. Compared to their Anglophone peers, Africa's Francophone countries operate in smaller markets and lack capital and mentors. Marion Diop is a venture capital investor at Orange Digital Ventures.
Et malheureusement, en Afrique francophone, ce n'est pas vraiment dans l'ADN.
She says that, unfortunately, in Francophone Africa, it is not in our DNA. People who succeed in business or in elected position do not necessarily reach back to help their peers to show them how to be successful. In the Anglophone world, it's a must for anyone who wants to start something, seeking advice. So the gap is not only financial between both spaces. Africa is the next frontier for venture capital, with its booming population and mobile-first economy. That's why Google, Facebook, and PayPal participated in Paris in AfroBytes 2019. Amin Youssouf is AfroBytes CEO.
We don't want people globally to see African tech as an exotic stuff. We want to be here. We want to talk about AI, about blockchain. We want to talk about what is happening in the Silicon Valley, because it has an impact on us. We already had brilliant minds in Africa for sure, but specialized in tech to have that kind of conversations.
Unlike the global trend where men dominate the high-tech industry, women are leading the movement in Africa. Ben White is a VC for Africa CEO. He has been supporting startups on the continent for more than 10 years.
So actually what we see in the statistics is that women involvement and participation on the African continent is much higher than you would find, for example, in New York or San Francisco. I think it's an advantage. And that also means having women investors who are very sensitive to gender-related questions and can also ensure that the systems that we're building are inclusive.
Governments in Africa are trying to regulate the activity and even support the sector. 40 Senegalese startups last November secured a total of $2 million in government funding. But some experts say government lack the skills needed to pick good investments. Ken Zalalu is the co-founder and managing partner at Outliers Ventures.
Public shelters should not invest. And this is what they actually, most of them are actually doing. They are not investing. But what they do is that they can they build funds of funds. So this is great. In Morocco, we have that in partnership with the World Bank. One of the local public organizations called CCG, they started a fund of funds called InnovInvest to invest in local funds, local VCs, so that they can de-risk.
With a population expected to reach 1.4 billion people by 2021 and a continent that will put about 1 billion smartphones into use within 2 years, Africa is a promising area for the world's leading high-tech and telecom companies. Nico Pino for VOA News, Paris.
Thanks for listening to International Edition.